would call it something else. "Which is?" he asked. "Doing what was necessary to protect you, your lands, and your people, Gareth Bryn. You blame me for the loss of a barn and some cows. Well, then I suggest that you consider the cost to your people should the Dragon Reborn fail. Sometimes prices must be paid so that a more important duty can be served. I would expect a soldier to understand that." "You should have told me," he said, still meeting her eyes. "You should have explained who you were." "What?" Swan asked. "Would you have believed me?" He hesitated. "Besides," she said frankly, "I didn't trust you. Our previous meeting had not been particularly amicable, as I recall. Could I have taken that risk, Gareth Bryn, on a man I did not know? Could I have given him control over the secrets I alone knew? Secrets that needed to be passed on to the new Ammerlin seat? Should I have spared even a moment when the entire world was wearing the hangman's noose?" She held those eyes, demanding an answer. "No," he finally admitted. "Burn me, Swan, but no. You shouldn't have waited. You shouldn't have made that oath in the first place." "You should have been more careful to listen," she said, finally breaking his gaze with a sniff. "I suggest that if you swear someone into service in the future, you be careful to stipulate a time frame for that service." Bryn grunted, and Swan whipped the final shirt off of the drying line, causing it to shake, making a blurry shadow on the back wall of the tent. "Well," Bryn said, "I told myself I'd only hold you to work as long as it took me to get that answer. Now I know. I would say that—" "Stop!" Swan snapped, spinning on him and pointing. "But don't say it," she threatened. "I'll gag you and leave you hanging in the air until sundown tomorrow. Don't think that I won't." Bryn sat, silent. "I'm not finished with you yet, Gareth Bryn." She whipped the shirt in her hands, then folded it. "I shall tell you when I am." "Light woman," he muttered almost under his breath. "If I'd known you were Aes Sedai before chasing you to Saladar, if I'd known what I was doing—" "What?" she demanded. "You wouldn't have hunted me down?" "Of course I would have," he said indignantly. "I'd have just been more careful and perhaps come better prepared. I went off hunting boars with a rabbit knife instead of a spear." Swan set the folded shirt on top of the others, then picked up the stack. She gave him a suffering look. "I will do my best to pretend that you didn't just compare me to a boar, Bryn. Kindly be a little more cautious with your tongue. Otherwise, you'll find yourself without a maidservant, and you'll have to let those ladies in the camp take up your laundry." He gave her a bemused look. Then he just laughed. She failed at keeping her own grin to herself. Well, after that exchange, he would know who was in control of this association. But light! Why had she told him about the foretelling? She'd rarely told anyone about that. As she packed the shirts in his trunk, she glanced at Bryn, who was still shaking his head and chuckling. "When other oaths no longer have a hold on me," she thought, "when I'm certain the Dragon Reborn is doing what he is supposed to, perhaps there will be time. For once I'm actually starting to look forward to being done with this quest. How remarkable." "You should be bedding down, Swan," Bryn said. "It's early yet," she said. "Yes, but it's sunset. Every third day you bed down uncharacteristically early, wearing that odd ring you have hidden between the cushions of your pallet." He turned over a paper on his desk. "Please give my kind regards to the Ammerlin." She turned toward him, slack-jawed. He couldn't know about Telairan Riod, could he? She caught him smiling in satisfaction. Well, perhaps he didn't know about Telairan Riod, but he'd obviously guessed that the ring and her schedule had something to do with communicating with Egwene. Sly. He glanced over the top of his papers at her as she passed, and his eyes had a twinkle to them. "Insufferable man," she muttered, sitting down on her pallet and dismissing her globe of light. Then she sheepishly fished out the ring Turangreal and put it around her neck, turned her back on him and lay down, trying to will herself to sleep. She made certain to rise early every third day so that she'd be tired at night. She wished she could put herself to sleep as easily as Egwene did. Insufferable, insufferable man! She'd have to do something to get back at him. Mice in the bedsheets. That would be a good payback. She lay for too long a time, but eventually coaxed herself to sleep, smiling faintly to herself at the prospect of an apt revenge. She awoke in Telairunriod wearing nothing but a scandalous, barely covering slip. She yelped, immediately replacing that, through concentration, with a green dress. Green? Why green? She made it blue. Light! How was it that Egwene was always so good at controlling things in Telairunriod, while Swan could barely keep her clothing from switching at every idle thought? It must have something to do with the fact that Swan had to wear this inferior Terangreal copy, which didn't work as well as the original. It made her look insubstantial to others who saw her. She was standing in the middle of the Aes Sedai camp, surrounded by tents. The flaps of any given structure would be open one moment, then closed the next. The sky was troubled by a violent yet strangely silent storm. Curious. But then things were often strange in Telairunriod. She closed her eyes, willing herself to appear in the study of the Mistress of Novices in the White Tower. When she opened her eyes, she was there. A small wood-paneled room with a stout desk and a table for strappings. She would have liked to have the original ring, but that was carefully kept by the sitters. She should be thankful for even a small catch, as her father had been fond of saying. She could have been left without any of the rings. The sitters thought this one had been with Lyanna when she'd been captured. Was Lyanna all right? At any moment the false Amyrlin could opt for execution. Swan knew all too well how spiteful Elida could be. She still felt a stab of sorrow when she thought of poor Alric. Had Elida felt a single moment of guilt over murdering a warder in cold blood before the woman she was tearing down had been properly deposed? "A sword, Swan?" Egwene's voice suddenly asked. "That's novel." Swan looked down, shocked to find herself holding a bloody sword, likely intended for Elida's heart. She made it vanish, then regarded Egwene. The girl looked the part of the Amyrlin, wearing that magnificent golden gown, her brown hair in an intricate arrangement set with pearls. Her face wasn't ageless yet, but Egwene was getting very good at the calm serenity of an Aes Sedai. In fact, she seemed to have grown measurably better at that since her capture. "You look well, Mother," Swan said. "Thank you," Egwene said with a faint smile. She showed more of herself around Swan than she did the others. They both knew how heavily Egwene had relied on Swan's teaching to get where she was. "Though she'd probably have made it there anyway," Swan admitted, "just not quite as quickly." Egwene glanced at the room around them, then grimaced faintly. "I realize I suggested this location last time, but I have seen enough of this room lately. I will meet you in the novices' dining hall." She vanished. An odd choice, but very unlikely to conceal unwanted ears. Swan and Egwene weren't the only ones who used Telairunriod for clandestine meetings. Swan closed her eyes. She didn't need to, but it seemed to help her, and imagined the novices' dining hall with its rows of benches and its bare walls. When she opened her eyes, she was there, as was Egwene. The Amyrlin settled back, and a majestic stuffed chair appeared behind her, catching her gracefully as she sat. Swan didn't trust herself to do anything so complicated. She simply sat down on one of the benches. "I think we may want to start meeting more frequently, Mother," Swan said, tapping the table as she ordered her thoughts. "Oh?" Egwene asked, sitting up straighter. "Has something happened?" "Several somethings," Swan said. "And I'm afraid a few of them smell as ripe as last week's catch."
"Tell me."
"One of the Forsaken was in our camp," Swan said. She hadn't wanted to think about that too frequently. The knowledge made her skin crawl. "Is anyone dead?" Egwene asked, voice calm, though her eyes looked to be steel. "No, bless the light," Swan said. "Other than those you already know about." Romanda made the connection. "Egwene, the creature had been with us for some time in hiding."
"Who?"
"Delana Mosalane," Swan said. "Or her serving woman, Halima. Most likely Halima, as I've known Delana for a great long time." Egwene's eyes widened just faintly. Halima had waited on Egwene. Egwene had been touched and served by one of the Forsaken. She took the news well, like an Amarlin. "But Anaya was killed by a man," Egwene said. "Were those murders different?"
"No. Anaya wasn't murdered by a man, but by a woman wielding Sidene. It must have been. It's the only thing that makes sense."
Egwene nodded slowly. "Anything was possible where the Dark One was concerned." Swan smiled in satisfaction and pride. This girl was learning to be Amarlin. Light, she was Amarlin.
"There's more?" Egwene asked.
"Not much more on this topic," Swan said. "They got away from us, unfortunately. Disappeared the very day we discovered them."
"What warned them, I wonder?"
"Well, that involves one of the other things I need to tell you."
Swan took a deep breath. The worst of it was out, but this next part wouldn't be much easier to stomach.
There was a meeting of the hall that day, attended by Delana. In that meeting, an Ashaman announced that he could sense a man channeling in the camp. We think that is what informed her. It wasn't until after Delana fled that we made the connection. It was that same Ashaman who told us that his fellow had encountered a woman who could channel Sidene.
"And why was an Ashaman in the camp?" Egwene asked coolly.
"He'd been sent as an envoy," Swan explained. "From the Dragon Reborn. Mother, it appears some of the men who follow Althor have bonded Aes Sedai."
Egwene blinked a single time.
"Yes. I had heard rumors of this. I had hoped that they were exaggerated. Did this Ashaman say who gave Rand permission to commit such an atrocity?"
"He's the Dragon Reborn," Swan said, grimacing. "I don't think he feels he needs permission. But in his defense, it appears he didn't know it was happening. The women his men bonded were sent by Elida to destroy the Black Tower."
"Yes," Egwene finally showed a sliver of emotion. "So the rumors are accurate. All too accurate." Her beautiful dress retained its shape, but bled to a deep brown in color, like Aiel clothing. Egwene didn't seem to notice the change.
"Will Elida's reign of disasters never cease?"
Swan just shook her head.
"We've been offered 47 Ashaman to bond as restitution of sorts for the women Althor's men bonded. Hardly a fair trade, but the Hall decided to accept the offer nonetheless."
"As well they should have," Egwene said. "We shall have to deal with the dragon's foolishness at a later date. Perhaps his men acted without his direct orders. But Rand must take responsibility."
"Men. Bonding women."
"They claim Sidene is cleansed," Swan said.
Egwene raised an eyebrow but did not object.
"Yes," she said. "I suppose that might be a reasonable possibility. We will need further confirmation, of course. But the taint arrived when all seemed one. Why should it not leave when all seems to be approaching pure madness?"
"I hadn't considered it that way," Swan said.
"Well, what should we do, Mother?"
"Let the Hall deal with it," Egwene said. "It seems they have matters in hand."
"They'd be better at keeping them in hand if you'd return, Mother."
"Eventually," Egwene said. She sat back and laced her fingers in her lap, somehow looking far older than her face would suggest. "My work is here, for now. You'll have to see that the Hall does as it should. I have great faith in you."
"And it's appreciated, Mother," Swan said, keeping her frustration inside. "But I'm losing control of them. Lilaine has begun to set herself up as a second Amarlin, and is doing it by pretending to support you. She's seen that appearing to act in your name serves herself. Egwene pursed her lips.
I would have thought Romanda would take the advantage, considering that she discovered the Forsaken.
I think she assumed she'd hold the advantage, Swan said, but she spent too long basking in her victory.
Lelaine has, with no small effort, become the most devoted servant of the Amyrlin who has ever lived. You would think that you and she were the closest of confidants to hear her speak. She's appropriated me as her attendant, and each time the hall meets, it's, Egwene wanted this, and remember what Egwene said when we did that.
Clever, Egwene said.
Brilliant, Swan said, sighing. But we knew one of them was eventually going to claw her way ahead of the other. I keep diverting her toward Romanda, but I don't know how long I can keep her distracted.
Do your best, Egwene said. But don't worry if Lelaine refuses to be diverted.
Swan frowned.
But she's usurping your place.
By building upon it, Egwene said, smiling. She finally noticed that her dress had changed to brown, for she switched it back in a heartbeat, not breaking the conversation.
Lelaine's gambit will only succeed if I fail to return. She is using me as a source of authority. When I return, she'll have no choice but to accept my leadership. She'll have spent all of her effort building me up.
And if you don't return, Mother? Swan asked softly.
Then it will be better for the Aes Sedai to have a strong leader, Egwene said. If Lelaine has been the one to secure that strength, then so be it.
She has good reason to make certain you don't return, you know, Swan said. At the very least, she's betting against you.
Well, she can't very well be blamed for that.
Egwene let down her guard enough to show a grimace.
I'd be tempted to bet against myself if I were on the outside. You'll simply have to deal with her, Swan. I can't let myself be distracted. Not when I see so much potential for success here, and not when there is an even greater price for failure.
Swan knew that stubborn set to Egwene's jaw. There would be no persuading her tonight. Swan would simply have to try again during their next meeting.
All of it, the cleansing, the Ashaman, the crumbling of the tower, made her shiver uncomfortably. Though she'd been preparing for these days for most of her life, it was still unsettling to have them finally arrive.
The last battle really is coming, Swan said, mostly to herself.
It is, Egwene said, voice solemn.
And I'm going to face it with barely a lick of my former power, Swan said, grimacing.
Well, perhaps we can get you an Angreal once the tower is whole again, Egwene said. We'll be using everything we have when we ride against the shadow.
Swan smiled. That would be nice, but not necessary. I'm just grumbling out of habit, I suppose. I'm actually learning to deal with my new situation. It's not so difficult to stomach, now that I see that it has some advantages.
Egwene frowned, as if trying to figure out what advantages there could be in lessened power. Finally, she shook her head.
Elaine once mentioned a room to me in the tower filled with objects of power. I assume it really exists?
Of course, Swan said. The basement storeroom. It's in the second level of the basement, on the northeast side. Little room with a plain wooden door, but you can't miss it. It's the only one in the hallway that is locked.
Egwene nodded to herself.
Well, I can't defeat Elida through brute force. Still, it is nice to know of that.
Is there anything else remarkable to report?
Not at the moment, Mother, Swan said.
Then return and get some sleep.
Egwene hesitated.
And next time, we'll meet in 2 days. Here in the novices' dining hall, though we may want to begin meeting out in the city. I don't trust this place. If there was a Forsaken in our camp, I'd bet half my father's inn that there's one spying on the White Tower, too.
Swan nodded.
Very well.
She closed her eyes and soon found herself blinking awake back in Bryn's tent. The candle was out, and she could hear Bryn breathing quietly from his pallet on the other side of the tent. She sat up and looked across at him, though it was too dark to see anything more than shadows. Strangely, after talking about Forsaken and Ashaman, the sturdy general's presence comforted her.
"Is there anything else remarkable to report, Egwene?" Swan thought idly, rising to change out of her dress behind the screen and put on her sleeping gown.
"I think I might be in love.
Is that remarkable enough?"
To her it seemed stranger than the taint being cleansed or a woman channeling Sidene. Shaking her head, she tucked the dream Tirangrial back in its hiding place, then snuggled down beneath her blankets. She'd forego the mice. Just this once.
Chapter 9. Leaving Maldon. A cool spring breeze tickled Perrin's face. Such a breeze should have carried with it the scents of pollen and crisp morning dew, of dirt overturned by sprouts pushing into the light, of new life and an earth reborn. This breeze carried with it only the scents of blood and death. Perrin turned his back to the breeze, knelt down and inspected the wagon's wheels. The vehicle was a sturdy construction of hickory, wood darkened with age. It appeared to be in good repair, but Perrin had learned to be careful when dealing with equipment from Maldon. The Shido didn't scorn wagons and oxen as they did horses, but they, like all Aiel, believed in traveling light. They hadn't maintained the wagons or carts, and Perrin had found more than one hidden flaw during his inspection. "Next," he bellowed as he checked the first wheel's hub. The comment was directed at the crowd of people waiting to speak with him. "My lord," a voice said. It was deep and rough, like wood scraping against wood. Gerard Arganda, first captain of Gildon. His scent was of well-oiled armor.
"I must press the issue of our departure. Allow me to ride ahead with Her Majesty."
The Her Majesty he referred to was Alejandra, Queen of Gildon. Perrin continued working with the wheel. He wasn't as familiar with carpentry as he was with smithing, but his father had taught each of his sons to recognize signs of trouble in a wagon. Better to fix the problem before leaving than to be stranded halfway to the destination. Perrin ran his finger across the smooth brown hickory. The grain was clearly visible, and he tested for cracks with questing fingers, searching each point of stress. All four wheels looked good.
"My lord," Arganda asked.
"We all march together," Perrin said. "That's my order, Arganda. I won't have the refugees thinking that we're abandoning them."
Refugees. There were over 100,000 of those to care for. 100,000? Like, that was far more than lived in the entire Two Rivers. And Perrin was in charge of feeding every one of them. Wagons. Many men didn't understand the importance of a good wagon. He lay down on his back, preparing to inspect the axles, and that gave him a view of the overcast sky, partially blocked by Maldon's nearby city wall. The city was large for one this far north in Altara. It was almost more of a fortress than a city, with daunting walls and towers. Until the day before, the land around this city had been home to the Shido Aiel. But they were gone now. Many killed, others fled, their captives freed by an alliance between Perrin's forces and the Shonchan. The Shido had left him two things, a scent of blood on the air, and 100,000 refugees to care for. Though he was happy to give them their freedom, his goal in liberating Maldon had been far different. The rescue of Fael. Another Aiel group had been advancing on his position, but they'd slowed, then camped, and were no longer rushing toward Maldon. Perhaps they'd been warned by Shido fleeing the battle that they had a large army before them, one that had defeated the Shido despite their channelers. It seemed this new group behind Perrin had as little desire to engage him as he had to engage them. That gave him time. A little bit, at least. Arganda was still watching. The captain wore his polished breastplate and had his slotted helmet under his arm. The squat man wasn't a puffed-up fluff of an officer, but a common man who had risen through the ranks. He fought well and did as instructed. Usually. I'm not going to bend on this, Arganda, Perrin said, pulling himself along the damp ground beneath the wagon.
Could we at least use gateways instead?
Arganda asked, kneeling down, graying hair shorn short, nearly brushing the ground as he peeked under the wagon.
The Ashaman are near dead from fatigue, Perrin snapped. You know that. They're too tired for a large gateway, Arganda said. But maybe they could send a small group. My lady is exhausted from her captivity. Surely you don't mean for her to march.
The refugees are too tired, Perrin said. Alejandra can have a horse to ride, but she's leaving when the rest of us do. Let's send that soon.
Arganda sighed, but nodded. He stood up as Perrin ran his fingers along the axle. He could tell stress in wood with a glance, but he preferred touch. Touch was more reliable. There was always a crack or a splintering where wood weakened, and you could feel it near to breaking. Wood was reliable like that. Unlike men. Unlike himself. He gritted his teeth. He didn't want to think about that. He had to keep working, had to keep doing something to distract himself. He liked to work. He'd been given far too few opportunities for it lately.
Next, he said, voice echoing against the bottom of the wagon.
My lord, we should attack,
a boisterous voice declared from beside the vehicle. Perrin thumped his head back against the well-trampled grass, closing his eyes.
Bertin Galen, Lord Captain of the Winged Guards, was to Mayen what Arganda was to Gildon. Aside from that single similarity, the two captains were about as different as men could be. Perrin could see Bertin's large, beautifully worked boots with clasps shaped like hawks from beneath the wagon.
My lord, Bertin continued, a fine charge from the Winged Guard would scatter that Aiel rabble. Of this I'm certain. Why, we easily dealt with the Aiel here in the city.
We had the Seanchan then, Perrin said, finishing with the rear axle and wriggling his way to the front to check the other one. He wore his old, stained coat. Fael would chastise him for that. He was supposed to present himself as a lord. But would she really expect him to wear a fine coat if he was going to spend an hour lying in the muddy grass looking at the bottoms of wagons? Fael wouldn't want him to be in the muddy grass in the first place. Perrin hesitated, hand on the front axle, thinking of her raven hair and distinctive Saldaean nose. She held the sum total of his love. She was everything to him. He had succeeded. He'd saved her. So why did he feel as if things were nearly as bad as they had been? He should rejoice. He should be ecstatic, should be relieved. He'd worried so much about her during her captivity. And yet now, with her safety secure, everything still felt wrong. Somehow. In ways he couldn't explain. Light. Would nothing just work as it was supposed to? He reached down for his pocket, wanting to finger the knotted cord he'd once carried there. But he'd thrown that away. Stop it, he thought. She's back. We can go back to the way it was before. Can't we?
Yes, well, Bertin continued. I suppose the departure of the Seanchan could be a problem in an assault. But that Aiel group camped out there is smaller than what we already defeated. And if you are worried, you could send word to that Seanchan general and bring her back. Surely she would wish to fight alongside us again.
Perrin forced himself back to the moment. His own foolish problems were irrelevant. Right now, he needed to get these wagons moving. The front axle was good. He turned and pushed himself out from underneath the wagon. Bertin was of medium height, though the three plumes rising from his helmet made him look taller. He had on his red eye patch. Perrin didn't know where he'd lost the eye, and his armor gleamed. He seemed excited, as if he thought Perrin's silence meant they would attack. Perrin stood, dusting off his plain brown trousers.
We're leaving, he said, then held up a hand to forbid further argument. We defeated the Septs here, but we had them dosed with fork root, and there were Damani on our side. We're tired, wounded, and we have Fael back. There's no further reason to fight. We run. Bertin didn't look satisfied, but he nodded and turned away, stomping across the muddy ground toward where his men sat their mounts. Perrin looked at the small group of people who waited in a cluster around the wagon to speak with him. Once, this kind of business had frustrated Perrin. It seemed like pointless work, as many of the supplicants already knew what his answer would be. But they needed to hear those answers from him, and Perrin had come to understand the importance of that. Besides, their questions helped distract him from the strange tension he felt at having rescued Fael. He walked toward the next wagon in line, his small entourage following him. There were a good 50 of the wagons set in a long caravan train. The first ones were loaded with salvage from Maldon. The middle ones were in the process of being treated likewise, and he had only two left to inspect. He had wanted to be well out of Maldon before sunset. That would probably carry him far enough away to be safe. Unless these new Shido decided to give chase in revenge. With the number of people Perrin had to move, a blind man would be able to track them. The sun drooped toward the horizon, a shining spot behind the cloud cover. Light, but this was a mess, with the chaos of organizing refugees and separate army camps. Getting away was supposed to be the easy part. The Shido camp was a disaster. His people had scavenged and packed many of the abandoned tents. Now cleared, the ground around the city was trampled weeds and mud, littered with refuse. The Shido, being Aiel, had preferred to camp outside the city walls, rather than within them. They were a strange people, no denying that. Who would spurn a nice bed, not to mention a better military position, to stay outside in tents? Aiel despised cities, though. Most of the buildings had either been burned during the initial Shido assault, or looted for riches. Doors beaten down, windows shattered, possessions abandoned on the streets and trampled by Gashin running back and forth to fetch water. People still scurried about like insects, moving through the city gates and around the former Shido camp, grabbing what they could to stow it for transport. They'd have to leave the wagons behind once they decided to travel. Grady couldn't make a gateway big enough to pass a wagon through. But for now, the vehicles would be a big help. There were also a good number of oxen. Someone else was inspecting those, making certain they were fit to pull the wagons. The Shido had let many of the city's horses run off. A shame, that. But you made use of what you had. Perrin reached the next wagon, beginning his inspection with the vehicle's long tongue, to which oxen would be harnessed.
"My lord," said a scratchy voice, "I believe that I am next."
Perrin glanced over at the speaker. Seben Bulwer, his secretary. The man had a dry, pinched face and a perpetual stoop that made him look almost like a roosting vulture. Though his coat and breeches were clean, it seemed to Perrin that they should shed puffs of dust each time Bulwer stepped. He smelled musty, like an old book. "Bulwer," Perrin said, running his fingers over the tongue, then checking the harness straps. "I thought you were speaking with the captives."
"I have indeed been busy with my work there," Bulwer said. "However, I grew curious. Did you have to let the Shon Chan take all of the captive Shido channelers with them?"
Perrin glanced at the musty secretary. The wise ones who could channel had been knocked unconscious by Forkroot. They'd been given over to the Shon Chan while still unconscious, to do with as they pleased. The decision had not made Perrin popular with the Aiel among his allies, but he would not have those channelers running about to take revenge on him.
"I don't see why I would want them," he said to Bulwer.
"Well, my lord, there is much of great interest to learn. For instance, it appears that many of the Shido are ashamed of their clan's behavior. The wise ones themselves were at odds. Also, they have had dealings with some very curious individuals who offered them objects of power from the Age of Legends. Whoever they were, they could make gateways.
Forsaken, Perrin said with a shrug, stooping down on one knee to check the right front wheel. I doubt we'll figure out which ones. Probably had a disguise on. From the corner of his eyes, he saw Bulwer purse his lips at that comment. You disagree? Perrin asked.
No, my lord, he said. The objects the Shido were given are very suspect, by my estimation. The Aiel were duped, though for what reason I cannot yet fathom. However, if we had more time to search the city...
Light. Was every person in the camp going to ask him for something they knew they couldn't have? He got down on the ground to check the back of the wheel hub. Something about it bothered him. We already know that the Forsaken oppose us, Bulwer. They won't rightly welcome Rand in with open arms to seal them away again, or whatever it is he's going to do. Blasted colors showing Rand in his mind's eye. He pushed those away again. They appeared whenever he thought of Rand or Matt, bringing visions of them. Anyway, Perrin continued, I don't see what you need me to do. We'll take the Shido Gaishine with us. The maidens captured their fair share. You can interrogate them. But we're leaving this place.
Yes, my lord, Bulwer said. It's just a shame we lost those wise ones. My experience has been that they are those among the Aiel with the most... understanding.
The Seanchan wanted them, Perrin said, so they got them. I wouldn't let Adara bully me on the point, and what is done is done. What do you expect of me, Bulwer?
Perhaps a message could be sent, Bulwer said, to ask some questions of the wise ones when they awake. I...
He stopped, then stooped down to glance at Perrin.
My lord, this is rather distracting. Couldn't we find someone else to inspect the wagons?
Everyone else is either too tired or too busy, Perrin said. I want most of the refugees waiting in the camps to move when we give the marching order. And most of our soldiers are scavenging the city for supplies. Each handful of grain they find will be needed. Half the stuff's spoiled anyway. I can't help with that work, since I need to be where people can find me. He'd accepted that, cross though it made him.
Yes, my lord, Bulwer said. But surely you can be somewhere accessible without crawling under wagons.
It's work I can do while people talk to me, Perrin said. You don't need my hands, just my tongue. And that tongue is telling you to forget the Aiel.
But...
There is nothing more I can do, Bulwer, Perrin said firmly, glancing up at him through the spokes of the wheel. We're heading north. I'm done with the Shido. They can burn for all I care. Bulwer pursed his thin lips again, and he smelled just slightly of annoyance.
Of course, my lord, he said, giving a quick bow.
Then he withdrew. Perrin squirmed out and stood up, nodding to a young woman who stood in a dirty dress and worn shoes at the side of the line of wagons. Go fetch Lincoln, he said. Tell him to have a look at this wheel hub. I think the bearing's been stripped, and the blasted thing looks ready to roll right off. The young woman nodded, running away. Lincoln was a master carpenter who had been unfortunate enough to be visiting relatives in Kyrian when the Shido attacked. He'd had the will beaten nearly out of him. Perhaps he should have been the one to inspect the wagons, but with that haunted look in his eyes, Perrin wasn't sure how far he trusted the man to do a proper inspection. He seemed good enough at fixing problems when they were pointed out to him, though. And the truth was, as long as Perrin kept moving, he felt he was doing something, making progress, not thinking about other issues. Wagons were easy to fix. They weren't like people. Not at all. Perrin turned, glancing across the empty camp, pocked with fire pits and discarded rags. Fael was walking back toward the city. She'd been organizing some of her followers to scout the area. She was striking, beautiful,
That beauty wasn't just in her face or her lean figure. It was in how easily she commanded people, how quickly she always knew what to do. She was clever in a way Perrin never had been. He wasn't stupid. He just liked to think about things. But he'd never been good with people. Not like Matt or Rand. Fael had shown him that he didn't need to be good with people, or even with women, as long as he could make one person understand him. He didn't have to be good at talking to anyone else, as long as he could talk to her. But now he couldn't find the words to say. He worried about what had happened to her during her captivity, but the possibilities didn't bother him. They made him angry, but none of what had happened was her fault. You did what you had to survive. He respected her for her strength.
Light, he thought. I'm thinking again. Need to keep working.
Next, he bellowed, stooping down to continue his inspection of the wagon.
If I'd seen your face and nothing else, lad, a hearty voice said, I'd assume that we'd lost this battle.
Perrin turned with surprise. He hadn't realized that Tam El'Thor was one of those waiting to speak with him. That crowd had thinned, but there were still some messengers and attendants. At the back, the blocky, solid sheepherder leaned on his quarterstaff as he waited. His hair had all gone to silver. Perrin could remember a time when it had been a deep black. Back when Perrin had just been a boy, before he'd known a hammer or a forge. Perrin's fingers reached down, touching the hammer at his waist. He'd chosen it over the axe. It had been the right decision, but he'd still lost control of himself in the Battle of Molden. Was that what bothered him? Or was it how much he'd enjoyed the killing?
What do you need, Tam? He asked. I'm only bringing a report, my lord, Tam said. The Two Rivers men are organized for the march, each man with 2 tents on his back just in case. We couldn't use water from the city on account of the fork route, so I sent some lads to the aqueduct to fill some barrels there. We could use a wagon to bring them back.
Done, Perrin said, smiling. Finally, someone who did things that were needed without having to ask first.
Tell the Two Rivers men that I intend to have them back home as soon as possible. The moment Grady and Niald are strong enough to make a gateway. That could be a while, though.
That's appreciated, my lord, Tam said.
It felt so strange for him to use a title.
Can I speak to you alone for a moment, though?
Perrin nodded, noticing that Lincoln was coming, his limp was distinctive, to look at the wagon. Perrin moved with Tam away from the group of attendants and guards, walking into the shadow of Molden's wall. Moss grew green against the base of the massive blocks making up the fortification. It was strange that the moss was far brighter than the trampled, muddied weeds under their feet. Nothing but moss seemed green this spring.
What is it, Tam?
Perrin asked as soon as they were far enough away. Tam rubbed his face. There was gray stubble coming in. Perrin had pushed his men hard these last few days, and there hadn't been time for shaving. Tam wore a simple blue wool coat, and the thick cloth was probably a welcome shield against the mountain breeze.
The lads are wondering, Perrin, Tam said, a little less formal now that they were alone. Did you mean what you said about giving up on Manetherin?
Aye, Perrin said. That banner has been nothing but trouble since it first came out. The Shan Chan and everyone else might as well know. I'm no king.
You have a queen who's sworn you as her liege.
He considered Tam's words, working out the best response. Once that kind of behavior had made people think he was slow of thought. Now people assumed his thoughtfulness meant that Perrin was crafty and keen-minded. What a difference a few fancy words in front of your name made.
I think you're right in what you did, Tam said surprisingly. Calling the Two Rivers Manetherin would not only have antagonized the Shan Chan, but the Queen of Andor herself. It would imply that you meant to hold more than just the Two Rivers, that perhaps you wanted to conquer all that Manetherin once held.
Perrin shook his head.
I don't mean to conquer anything, Tam. Light. I don't mean to hold what people say I've got. The sooner that Elaine takes her throne and sends a proper lord out to the Two Rivers, the better. We can be done with all of this Lord Perrin business and things can go back to normal.
And Queen Aleandra?
Tam asked.
She can swear to Elaine instead, Perrin said stubbornly. Or maybe directly to Rand. He seems to like scooping up kingdoms, like a child playing a game of wobbles.
Tam smelled concerned, troubled. Perrin looked away. Things should be simpler. They should be.
What?
I just thought you were over this, Tam said.
Nothing has changed from the days before Fael was taken, Perrin said. I still don't like that wolfhead banner either. I think maybe it's time to take that one down, too.
The men believe in that banner, Perrin, lad, Tam said quietly. He had a soft way about him, but that made you listen when he spoke. Of course, he also usually spoke sense.
I pulled you aside because I wanted to warn you. If you provide a chance for the lads to return to the Two Rivers, some will go, but not many. I've heard most swear that they'll follow you to Sheol Ghul. They know the last battle is coming. Who couldn't know that, with all of the signs lately? They don't intend to be left behind.
He hesitated.
And neither do I reckon.
He smelled of determination.
We'll see, Perrin said, frowning. We'll see.
He sent Tam off with orders to requisition a wagon and take it for those water barrels. The soldiers would listen. Tam was Perrin's first captain, though that seemed backward to Perrin. He didn't know much of the man's past, but Tam had fought in the Aiel War long ago. He'd held a sword before Perrin had been born. And now he followed Perrin's orders. They all did. And they wanted to keep doing so. Hadn't they learned? He rested back against the wall, not walking back to his attendants, standing in the shadow. Now that he seized upon it, he realized that was a part of what was bothering him. Not the whole of it, but some, tied in with what was troubling him. Even now that Fael had returned. He hadn't been a good leader lately. He'd never been a model one, of course, not even when Fael had been there to guide him. But during her absence, he'd been worse, far worse. He'd ignored his orders from Rand, ignored everything, all to get her back. But what else was a man supposed to do? His wife had been kidnapped. He'd saved her, but in doing so, he'd abandoned everyone else. And because of him, men were dead, good men, men who had trusted in him. Standing in that shadow, he remembered a moment, only a day past, when an ally had fallen to Aiel arrows, his heart poisoned by Massima. Aram had been a friend, one that Perrin had discarded in his quest to save Fael. Aram had deserved better.
I should never have let that tinker pick up a sword, he thought.
But he didn't want to deal with this problem right now. He couldn't. There was too much to do. He moved away from the wall, planning to inspect the last wagon in line.
Next,
he barked as he began again. Aravine Carnell stepped forward. The Amadisian woman no longer wore her Gaishine robes. Instead, she had on a simple light green dress, not clean, that had been pulled out of the salvage. She was plump, but her face still bore a haggard cast from her days as a captive. There was a determination about her. She was surprisingly good at organization, and Perrin suspected she was of noble heritage. She had the scent of it about her, self-confidence, and ease giving commands. It was a wonder those things had survived her captivity. As he knelt down to look at the first wheel, he figured it was odd that Fael had chosen Aravine to supervise the refugees. Why not one of the youths from Chafail? Those dandies could be annoying, but they'd shown a surprising measure of competence.
My lord, Aravine said, her practiced curtsy another indication of her background. I have finished organizing the people for departure.
So soon?
Perrin asked, looking up from the wheel.
It was not so difficult as we expected, my lord. I commanded them to gather by nationality, then by town of birth. Not surprisingly, the Kyrianin form the largest bulk of them, followed by Altarans, then Amadisians, with some smattering of others. A few Domani, some Terrabanners, the occasional Borderlander or Tyran.
How many can stand a day or two of marching without a ride in the wagons?
Most of them, my lord, she said. The sick and elderly were expelled from the city when the Shido took it. The people here are accustomed to being worked hard. They're exhausted, lord, but none too eager to be waiting here with those other Shido camped not half a day's march away.
All right, Perrin said. Start them marching immediately.
Immediately?
Aravin asked with surprise. He nodded.
I want them on that road marching northward as soon as you can get them going. I'll send Aleandra and her guard to lead the way.
That ought to keep our Ganda from complaining, and it would get the refugees out of the way. The maidens would be far better and far more efficient at gathering supplies alone. The scavenging was nearly finished anyway. His people would have to survive on the road for only a few weeks. After that, they could jump via Gateway to some place more secure. Andor, perhaps, or Kyrian. Those Shido behind him had him anxious. They could decide to attack at any time. Better to get away and remove the temptation. Aravin curtsied and hurried away to make preparations, and Perrin thanked the light for someone else who didn't see a need to question or second-guess him. He sent a boy to inform Arganda of the impending march, then finished his inspection of the wagon. After that, he stood up, wiping his hands on his trousers.
Next, he said.
Nobody stepped forward. The only people remaining around him were guards, messenger boys, and a few wagoneers waiting to hitch up their oxen and move the wagons off for loading. The maidens had made a large pile of foodstuffs and supplies in the middle of the former camp, and Perrin could make out Fael there working to organize it. Perrin sent the ring of attendants with him over to help her, then found himself alone, with nothing to do. Just what he'd wanted to avoid. The wind blew past again, carrying that awful stench of death. It also carried memories. The fury of the battle, the passion and thrill of each swing. Aiel were excellent warriors, the best the land knew. Each exchange had been close, and Perrin had earned his share of cuts and bruises, though those had since been healed. Fighting the Aiel had made him feel alive. Each one he'd slain had been an expert with the spears. Each one could have killed him. But he'd won. During those moments of fighting, he'd felt a driving passion. The passion of finally doing something. After 2 months of waiting, each blow had meant a step closer to finding Fael. No more talking, no more planning. He'd found purpose. And now it was gone. He felt hollow. It was like the time when his father had promised him something special as a gift for winter night. Perrin had waited months, eager, doing his chores to earn the unknown gift. When he'd finally received the small wooden horse, he'd been excited for a moment. But the next day, he'd been shockingly melancholy. Not because of the gift, but because there had no longer been anything to strive for. The excitement was gone, and only then had he realized how much more precious he'd found that anticipation than the gift itself. Soon after that, he'd begun visiting Master Luhan's forge, eventually becoming his apprentice. He was glad to have Fael back. He rejoiced. And yet now, what was there for him? These blasted men saw him as their leader. Some even thought of him as their king. He'd never asked for that. He'd had them put away the banners every time they put them out, up until Fael had persuaded him that using them would be an advantage. He still didn't believe that the Wolfhead banner belonged there, flapping insolently above his camp. But could he take it down? The men did look to it. He could smell pride on them every time they passed it. He couldn't turn them away. Rand would need their aid. He'd need everyone's aid at the last battle. The last battle. Could a man like him,
a man who didn't want to be in charge, lead these forces to the most important moment in their lives? The colors swirled, showing him Rand sitting in what appeared to be a stone Tyran home. Perrin's old friend had a dark cast to his expression, like a man troubled by weighty thoughts. Even sitting like that, Rand looked regal. He was what a king was supposed to be, with that rich red coat, that noble bearing. Perrin was just a blacksmith. He sighed, shaking his head and dispelling the image. He needed to seek out Rand. He could feel something tugging at him, pulling him. Rand needed him. That had to be his focus now. Chapter 10. The Last of the Tabak. Rodolai Taralda puffed quietly on his pipe, smoke curling from it like the sinuous coils of a snake. The smoke tendrils wrapped around themselves, pooling at the ceiling above him, then leaking out through cracks in the roof of the ramshackle shed. The boards in the walls were warped from age, opening slits to the outside, and the gray wood was cracked and splintering. A brazier burned in the corner, and winds whistled through the cracks in the walls. Iteralda faintly worried those winds would blow over the entire building. He sat on a stool, several maps on the table before him. At the corner of the table, his tabak pouch weighed down a wrinkled piece of paper. The small square was weathered and folded from being carried in his inside coat pocket. "Well?" Rajabi asked. Thick of neck and determined of attitude, he was brown-eyed with a wide nose and a bulbous chin. He was completely bald now and faintly resembled a large boulder. He tended to act like a boulder, too. It could take a lot of work to get him rolling. But once you did, he was bloody hard to stop. He had been one of the first to join Iteralda's cause, for all the fact that he had been poised to rebel against the king just a short time before. It had been nearly 2 weeks since Iteralda's victory at Darluna. He'd extended himself far for that victory, perhaps too far. "Ah, Al-Salam," he thought. "I hope this was all worth it, old friend. I hope you haven't just gone mad. Rajabi might be a boulder, but the Shanchan are an avalanche, and we've brought them thundering down upon us." "What now?" Rajabi prodded. "We wait," Iteralda said. Light, but he hated waiting. "Then we fight, or maybe we run again. I haven't made up my mind yet." "The Terrabanners won't come," Iteralda said.
"They promised."
"They did." Iteralda had gone to them himself, had roused them, had asked them to fight the Shanchan just one more time. They'd yelled and cheered, but had not followed with any haste. They would drag their feet. He'd gotten them to fight one last time on half a dozen different occasions now. They could see where this war was going, and he could no longer depend on them. If he'd ever been able to in the first place.
"Bloody cowards," Rajabi muttered. "Light, burn them then. We'll do it alone. We have before."
Iteralda took a long, contemplative puff on his pipe. He'd chosen to finally use the Two Rivers tabak. This pipeful was the last in his store. He'd been saving it for months now. Good flavor. Best there was. He studied his maps again, holding a smaller one up before him. He could use better maps, that was certain. "This new Shanchan general," Iteralda said, "is marshaling over 300,000 men with a good 200 Damani."
"We've beat large forces before. Look what we did at Darluna. You crushed them, Rodal."
And doing so had required every bit of craftiness, skill, and luck Iteralda could muster. Even then he'd lost well over half his men. Now he ran, limping before this second, larger force of Shanchan. This time they weren't making any mistakes. The Shanchan didn't rely solely on their Rakan. His men had intercepted several foot scouts, and that meant dozens hadn't been caught. This time the Shanchan knew Iteralda's true numbers and his true location.
His enemies were done being herded and goaded. Instead, they hunted him, relentlessly, avoiding his traps. Iteralda had planned to retreat deeper and deeper into Arad-Duman. That would favor his forces and stretch the Shonshan supply lines. He'd figured he could keep it up for another 4 or 5 months. But those plans were useless now. They'd been made before Iteralda had discovered there was an entire bloody army of Aiel running about Arad-Duman. If the reports were to be believed, and reports about Aiel were often exaggerations, so he wasn't sure how much to believe, there were upwards of 100,000 of them holding large sections of the north, Bandar Eben included. 100,000 Aiel. That was as good as 200,000 Dumani troops, perhaps more. Iteralda well remembered the blood snow 20 years ago, when it had seemed he'd lost 10 men for each Aiel who fell. He was trapped, a walnut crushed between 2 stones. The best he'd been able to do was retreat here, to this abandoned steading. That would give him an edge against the Shonshan, but only a small one. The Shonshan had a force 6 times the size of his own, and the greenest of commanders knew that fighting those odds was suicide. "Have you ever seen a master juggler, Rajabi?" Iteralda asked, studying the map. From the corner of his eye, Iteralda saw the bull-like man frown in confusion. "I've seen gleemen who..." "No, not a gleeman. A master." Rajabi shook his head. Iteralda puffed in thought before speaking. "I did once. He was the court bard of Camelon, spry fellow, with a wit that might better have belonged in a common room, for all the way he was decorated. Bards don't often juggle, but this fellow didn't mind the request. He liked juggling to please the young daughter heir, so I understand." He removed the pipe from his mouth, tapping down the tabak. "Rodol," Rajabi said. "The Shonshan..." Rodol held up a finger, situating his pipe, before continuing. "The bard started by juggling 3 balls. Then he asked us if we thought he could do another. We cheered him on. He went to 4, then 5, then 6. With each ball he added, our applause grew greater, and he always asked if we thought he could do another. Of course, we said yes. 7, 8, 9. Soon he had 10 balls going in the air, flying in a pattern so complex that I couldn't track them. He had to strain to keep them going. He kept having to reach down and grab balls that he nearly missed. He was too lost in concentration to ask us if he should add another, but the crowd called for it. 11. Go for 11. And so his assistant tossed another ball into the mess. Iteralda puffed. "He dropped them?" Rajabi asked. Rodol shook his head. "That last ball wasn't actually a ball at all. It was some kind of illuminator's trick. Once it got halfway to the bard, it flashed and gave off a sudden burst of light and smoke. By the time our vision cleared, the bard was gone, and 10 balls were lined up on the floor. When I looked around, I found him sitting at one of the tables with the rest of the diners, drinking a cup of wine and flirting with Lord Findal's wife." Poor Rajabi looked completely dumbfounded. He liked his answers neat and straightforward. Iteralda usually felt the same way. But these days, with their unnaturally overcast skies and sense of perpetual gloom, made him philosophic. He reached out and took the worn folded sheet of paper off the table from beneath his tabak pouch. He handed it to Rajabi. "Strike hard against the Shonshan," Rajabi read. "Push them away. Force them into their boats and back across their bloody ocean. I'm counting on you, old friend. King Al-Salam." Rajabi lowered the letter. "I know of his orders, Rodol. I didn't come into this because of him. I came because of you." "Yes, but I fight because of him," Iteralda said. He was a king's man. He always would be. He stood up, tapping out his tabak and grinding the embers beneath the heel of his boot. He set the pipe aside and took the letter from Rajabi, then walked to the door.
He needed to make a decision. Stay and fight, or flee for a worse location, but gain a little more time. The shack groaned, and wind shook the trees as Iteralda stepped outside into the overcast morning. The shed wasn't Ogier built, of course. It was too flimsy for that. This steading had been abandoned for a long time. His men camped amid the trees. Hardly the best location for a war camp, but one made soup with the spices on hand. The steading was far too useful to pass up. Another man might have fled to a city and hidden behind its walls. But here in these trees, the one power was useless. Negating the Shonchan Damani was better than walls, no matter how high. We have to stay, Iteralda thought, watching his men work, digging in, erecting a palisade. He hated the thought of cutting down trees in a steading. He'd known a few Ogier in his time, and respected them. These massive oaks probably held some lingering strength from the days when the Ogier had lived here. Cutting them down was a crime, but you did what you had to. Running might gain him more time, but it might just as easily lose him time. He had a few days here before the Shonchan hit him. If he could dig in well, he might force them into a siege. The steading would make them hesitant, and the forests would work to the advantage of Iteralda's smaller force. He hated letting himself get pinned in. That was probably why he'd considered for so long, even though deep down he'd already known that it was time to stop running. The Shonchan had finally caught him. He continued along the ranks, nodding to working men, letting himself be seen. He had 40,000 troops left, which was a marvel considering the odds they had faced. These men should have deserted, but they'd seen him win impossible battle after impossible battle, tossing ball after ball into the air to greater and greater applause. They thought he was unstoppable. They didn't understand that when one tossed more balls into the air, it wasn't just the show that became more spectacular. The fall at the end grew more spectacular as well. He kept his dark thoughts to himself as he and Rajabi continued through the forested camp, inspecting the palisade. It was progressing nicely, the men setting thick tree trunks into freshly dug troughs. After his inspection, Iteralda nodded to himself. We stay, Rajabi. Pass the word. Some of the others say that staying here means dying for sure, Rajabi responded. They're wrong, Iteralda said. But nothing is sure, Rajabi, Iteralda said. Fill these trees inside the palisade with archers. They'll be almost as effective as towers. We'll need to set up a killing field outside. Cut down as many trees around the palisade here as possible. Then set the logs inside as barriers, a second line of retreat. We'll hold strong. Perhaps I'm wrong about those Terrabonners, and they'll ride to aid us. Or maybe the king has a hidden army stashed away to defend us. Blood and ashes, maybe we'll fight them off here on our own. We'll see how much they like fighting without their Damani. We'll survive. Rajabi straightened visibly, growing confident. That was the kind of talk Iteralda knew he expected. Like the others, Rajabi trusted the little wolf. They didn't believe he could fail. Iteralda knew better. But if you're going to die, you did it with dignity. The young Iteralda had often dreamed of wars, of the glory of battle. The old Iteralda knew there was no such thing as glory to be had in battle. But there was honor.
My lord Iteralda,
a runner called, trotting along the inside of the unfinished palisade wall. He was a boy, young enough that the Shonchan would probably let him live. Otherwise Iteralda would have sent the lad and those like him away. Yes, Iteralda asked, turning. Rajabi stood like a small mountain at his side.
A man, the boy said, puffing. The scouts caught him walking into the steading.
Come to fight for us, Iteralda said.
It was not uncommon for an army to draw recruits. There were always those tempted by the lure of glory, or at least by the lure of steady meals.
No, my lord, the boy said, puffing. He says he's come to see you.
Shonchan, Rajabi barked.
The boy shook his head.
No, But he's got nice clothes.
Some lord's messenger, then. Damani, or perhaps a Terrabanner renegade. Whoever he was, he could hardly make their situation worse.
And he came alone? Yes, sir.
Brave man.
Bring him, then, Aitaralda said.
Where will you receive him, my lord?
What? Aitaralda snapped. You think I'm some fancy merchant with a palace? The field here will do. Go get him. But take your time getting back, and make sure he's properly guarded.
The boy nodded and ran off. Aitaralda waved over some soldiers and sent them running for Wakeda and the other officers. Shimron was dead, burned to char by Damani's fireball. Too bad, that. Aitaralda would rather have kept him than many of the others. Most of the officers arrived before the stranger. Lanky Ankare, one-eyed Wakeda, who might otherwise have been a handsome man, squat Malarnid, youthful Lidrin, who continued to follow Aitaralda after his father's death.
"What is this I hear?" Wakeda asked, folding his arms as he strode up. "We're staying in this death trap? Rudal, we don't have the troops to resist. If they come, we'll be trapped here."
"You're right," Aitaralda said simply. Wakeda turned to the others, then back to Aitaralda, a little of his irritation deflated in the face of Aitaralda's frank answer.
"Well, why don't we run, then?"
He blustered a lot less now than he had just months ago when Aitaralda had first begun this campaign.
"I won't give you sugar and lies," Aitaralda said, looking at them each in turn. "We're in bad shape, but we'll be in a worse shape if we run. We've got no more holes to hide in. These trees will work to our advantage, and we can fortify. The steading will negate the Damani, and that alone is worth the price of staying. We fight here."
Ankare nodded, seeming to understand the gravity of the situation.
"We have to trust him, Wakeda. He's led us right so far."
Wakeda nodded.
"I suppose."
Bloody fools. 4 months ago, half of them would have killed him on sight for staying loyal to the king. Now they thought he could do the impossible. It was a pity. He was beginning to think he could have brought them back to Al-Salama's loyalists.
"All right," he said, pointing at various spots along their fortification. "Here's what we're going to do to shore up the weak points. I want..."
He trailed off as he saw a group approaching through the clearing. The messenger boy, accompanied by a squad of soldiers, escorting a man in red and gold. Something about the newcomer drew Aitaralda's eyes. Perhaps it was the height. The young man was as tall as an Aiel, and fair of hair like them as well. But no Aiel dressed in a fine red coat with sharp golden embroidery. There was a sword at his side, and the way the newcomer walked made Aitaralda think he knew how to use it. He strode with firm, determined steps, as if he thought the soldiers around him an honor guard. A lord, then, and one accustomed to command. Why had he come in person, rather than sending a messenger? The young lord stopped a short length in front of Aitaralda and his generals, looking at each of them in turn, then focused on Aitaralda.
"Rodil Aitaralda?" he asked.
What accent was that? Andorin?
"Yes," Aitaralda said cautiously.
The young man nodded.
"Bashir's description was accurate. You appear to be boxing yourself in here. Do you honestly expect to hold against the Shonchan army? They are many times your size, and your Terraban allies do not appear eager to join you in your defense."
He had good intelligence, whoever he was.
"I am not in the habit of discussing my defenses with strangers."
Aitaralda studied the young lord. He was fit, lean and hard, though it was difficult to tell with the coat on. He favored his right hand, and on closer inspection, Aitaralda noticed that the left hand was missing. Both of his forearms had some kind of strange red and gold tattoo on them.
Those eyes. Those were eyes which had seen death a number of times. Not just a young lord, a young general.
Aitaralda narrowed his eyes.
"Who are you?"
The stranger met his eyes.
I am Randall Thor, the Dragon Reborn. And I need you. You and your army.
Several of those with Iteralda cursed, and Iteralda glanced at them. Wakeda was incredulous, Rajabi surprised, young Lydrin openly dismissive. Iteralda looked back at the newcomer. The Dragon Reborn? This youth? He supposed it could be possible. Most rumors agreed that the Dragon Reborn was a young man with red hair, but then rumors also claimed he was 10 feet tall, and still others said his eyes glowed in dim light. And then there were the stories of him appearing in the sky at Falma. Blood and ashes, Iteralda didn't know if he believed that the dragon had been reborn in the first place.
I haven't time to argue, the stranger said, face impassive. He seemed older than he looked. He didn't appear to care that he was surrounded by armed soldiers. In fact, his coming alone, it should have seemed like such a foolish act. Instead, it made Iteralda thoughtful. Only one such as the Dragon Reborn himself could stride into a war camp like this, completely alone, and expect to be obeyed. Burn him, if that fact by itself didn't make Iteralda want to believe him. Either this man was who he claimed to be, or he was an utter lunatic.
If we go outside the steading, I will prove I can channel, the stranger said. That should count for something. Give me leave, and I'll have 10,000 Aiel here, and several Aes Sedai, all of whom will swear to you that I am who I say. The rumors also said Aiel followed the Dragon Reborn. The men around Iteralda coughed and glanced about uncomfortably. Many had been dragons sworn before coming to Iteralda. With the right words, this Randall Thor, or whoever he was, might be able to turn Iteralda's camp against itself.
Even if we assume that I believe you, Iteralda said carefully, I don't see that it matters. I have a war to fight. You have other business to concern you, I assume.
You are my concern, Althor said, eyes so hard that they seemed ready to burrow into Iteralda's skull and search about inside for anything of use.
You must make peace with the Seanchan. This war gains us nothing. I want you up on the borderlands. I can't spare men to guard the Blight, and the borderlanders themselves have abandoned their duties.
I have orders, Iteralda said, shaking his head.
Wait, he wouldn't do as this youth asked if he didn't have orders. Except those eyes.
El-Salam had had eyes like that when they were both younger, eyes that demanded obedience.
Your orders, Althor said. They are from the king. That is why you throw yourselves against the Seanchan as you do?
Iteralda nodded.
I've heard of you, Rodol Iteralda, Althor said. Men I trust, men I respect, trust and respect you. Rather than fleeing and hiding, you hunker down here to fight a battle you know will kill you. All because of your loyalty to your king. I commend that. But it is time to turn away and fight a battle that means something. One that means everything.
Come with me and I'll give you the throne of Arad-Daman.
Iteralda stood up sharply, alert. After commending my loyalty, you expect me to unseat my own king?
Your king is dead, Althor said. Either that or his mind has been melted like wax. More and more I think Grendel has him. I see her touch on the chaos in this land. Whatever orders you have likely came from her. Why she wants you fighting the Seanchan, I haven't yet been able to determine.
Iteralda snorted. You speak of one of the Forsaken as if you've had her as a dinner guest.
Althor met his eyes again. I remember each of them. Their faces, their mannerisms, the way they speak and act. As if I've known them for 1,000 years. I remember them better than I remember my own childhood sometimes. I am the Dragon Reborn.
Iteralda blinked. Burn me, he thought. I believe him. Bloody ashes. Let's see this proof of yours.
There were objections, of course, mostly from Lydrin, who thought it too dangerous. The others were shaken. Here was the man they'd sworn themselves to without ever meeting him. There seemed to be a force about Althor, drawing Iteralda in, demanding that he do as asked. Well, he'd see the proof first. They sent runners for horses to ride out of the steading, but Althor spoke as if Iteralda was his man already. "Perhaps Al-Salam lives," Althor said as they waited. "If so, I can see that you would not want his throne. Would you like Amadicia? I will need someone to rule there and keep an eye on the Shan Chan. The White Cloaks fight there now. I'm not sure if I'll be able to stop that conflict before the last battle." The last battle. Light. "I won't take it if you kill the king there," Iteralda said. "If the White Cloaks have already killed him, or if the Shan Chan have, then perhaps..." King? What was he saying? "Burn you," he thought to himself. "At least wait until the proof is given before agreeing to accept thrones." There was a way about this man, the way he discussed events like the last battle, events that mankind had been fearing for thousands of years, as if they were items on the daily camp report. Soldiers arrived with their horses, and Iteralda mounted, as did Althor, Wakeda, Rajabi, Ankar, Malarnid, Lydrin, and half a dozen lesser officers. "I've brought a large number of Aiel into your lands," Randalthor said as they began to ride. "I had hoped to use them to restore order, but they are taking longer than I'd wished. I'm planning to secure the members of the Merchant Council. Perhaps once I have them in hand, I'll be able to improve the stability of the area. What do you think?" Iteralda didn't know what to think. Securing the Merchant Council? That sounded like kidnapping them. What had Iteralda gotten himself into? "It could work," he found himself saying. "Light is probably the best plan, all things considered." Althor nodded, looking forward as they passed out of the palisade and moved out along a trail toward the edge of the steading. "I'll have to secure the borderlands anyway. I will care for your homeland. Burn those borderlanders. What are they up to? No. No, not yet. They can wait. No, he'll do. He can hold it. I'll send him with Ashaman." Suddenly, Althor turned to Iteralda. "What could you do if I gave you 100 men who could channel?"
"Madmen?"
"No, most of them are stable," Althor said, taking no apparent offense. "Whatever madness they incurred before I cleansed the taint is still there. Removing the taint didn't heal them. But few of them were far gone. And they won't get worse, now that Saidin is clean."
"Saidin? Clean?"
If Iteralda had his own men who could channel, his own Dumani, in a way. Iteralda scratched his chin. It was coming at him quickly, but then a general had to be able to react quickly.
"I could use them well," he said. "Very well."
"Good," Althor said. They had left the steading. The air felt different.
"You've got a lot of land to watch, but many of the channelers I'll give you can spin gateways."
"Gateways?" Iteralda asked. Althor glanced at him, then seemed to grit his teeth, closing his eyes, shaking as if nauseated. Iteralda sat upright, suddenly alert, hand on his sword. Poison? Was the man wounded? But no, Althor opened his eyes, and there seemed to be a look of ecstasy in those depths. He turned, waving a hand, and a line of light split the air in front of him. Men around Iteralda cursed, backing up. It was one thing for a man to claim he could channel. It was another to see him do so in front of you.
"That's a gateway," Althor said as the line of light turned around, opening a large black hole in the air.
"Depending on the Ashaman's strength, a gateway can be made wide enough to drive wagons through. You can travel nearly anywhere with speed, sometimes instantly, depending on circumstances. With a few trained Ashaman, your army could dine in Camelin in the morning, then have lunch in Tanchico a few hours later." Iteralda rubbed his chin.
Well now, that's a thing to see. A thing to see indeed.
If this man spoke truthfully, and these gateways really did work, with this I could clear the Shanchan out of Terrabon, and maybe off the land entirely.
No, Althor snapped. We make peace with them. From what my scouts say, it's going to be hard enough to bring them to agreement without promising them your head. I won't rile them further. There is no time for squabbling. We have more important matters to be about.
Nothing is more important than my homeland, Iteralda said. Even if those orders are forged, I know Al-Salam. He would agree with me. We won't stand for foreign troops on the soil of Arad Domon.
A promise, then, Althor said.
I will see the Shanchan out of Arad Domon. I promise you this. But we don't fight them away any further than that. In exchange, you go to the borderlands and protect against an invasion there. Hold back the Trollocs if they come, and lend me some of your officers to help secure Arad Domon. It will be easier to restore order if the people see that their own lords are working with me.
Iteralda considered, though he knew already what his answer would be. That gateway could spirit his men away from this death trap. With Aiel on his side, with the dragon reborn as an ally, he really did have a chance of keeping Arad Domon secure.
An honorable death was a good thing, but the ability to keep on fighting with honor, that was a prize far more precious.
Agreed, Iteralda said, holding out a hand.
Althor took it.
Go break camp. You'll be in Saldea by nightfall.
Chapter 11. The Death of Adrin. I think he should be beaten again, said Larian, moving her fingers in the complex motions of maiden hand talk. He is like a child, and when a child touches something dangerous, the child is beaten. If a child hurts himself because he was not taught properly to stay away from knives, then the shame is upon his parents. The previous beating did not seem to do any good, Suriel replied. He accepted it like a man, not a child, but did not change his actions. Then we must try again, Larian replied. Avienda dropped her rock into the pile by the watchpost, then turned around. She did not acknowledge the maidens who watched the way into the camp, and they did not acknowledge her. Speaking to her while she was being punished would only heighten her shame, and her spear sisters would not do that. She also didn't indicate that she understood their conversation. While nobody expected a former handmaiden to forget hand talk, it was best to be unobtrusive. The hand talk belonged to the maidens. Avienda selected a large stone from the second pile, then began to walk back into camp. If the maidens continued their conversation, she could not tell, as she could no longer see their hands. But their discussion lingered with her. They were angered that Rand Althor had gone to meet with the general, Rodal Iteralda, without guards. It was not the first time he had acted so foolishly, and yet he seemed unwilling, or unable, to learn the proper way. Each time he put himself in danger without protection, he insulted the maidens as surely as if he had slapped each one in the face. Avienda probably had some small toe toward her spear sisters. Teaching Rand Althor of Aiel ways had been her task, and she had quite obviously failed. Unfortunately, she had a much greater toe toward the wise ones, even if she still didn't know the reason. Her lesser duty to her spear sisters would have to wait for an appropriate time. Her arms ached from carrying rocks. They were smooth and heavy. She had been required to dig them out of the river beside the manor house. Only her time spent with Elaine, when she had been forced to bathe in water, had given her the strength to walk into that river. In that she had not shamed herself. And at least this river was a small one. Wetlanders might inaccurately call it a stream. A stream was a tiny mountain runoff in which you could dip your hands or fill a water skin. Anything too large to step across was definitely a river. The day was overcast, as usual, and the camp was subdued. Men who had bustled just days before, when the Aiel had arrived, were more lethargic now. The camp wasn't by any means unkempt. Davram Bashir was too careful a commander to allow that, wetlander though he was. However, the men did move more slowly. She'd heard some of them complain that the dark sky was dampening their moods. How strange wetlanders were. What did the weather have to do with one's mood? She could understand being displeased that no raids were approaching, or that a hunt had gone poorly. But because there were clouds in the sky? Was shade so poorly appreciated here? She shook her head, continuing on her way. She had chosen stones which would strain her muscles. To do otherwise would have been to make light of her punishment, and she wouldn't do that, although each step pained her honor. She had to cross through the entire camp in full sight, doing work that was useless. She would rather have been naked before them all outside of the sweat tent. She would rather have run 1,000 laps or been beaten so hard that she couldn't walk. She reached the side of the manor house and deposited her stone with a hidden sigh of relief. 2 wetlander soldiers from Bashir's army stood guarding the door into the manor, a counterpart to the 2 maidens at the other end of Avienda's trek. As she stooped and picked up a large stone from a 2nd pile by the wall, she overheard them speaking.
"Burn me, but it's hot," one of the men complained. "Hot?" the other one replied, glancing at the overcast sky. "You're jesting."
The 1st guard waved his hand at himself, puffing out and sweating.
"How can you not feel that? You must have a fever or something."
The 1st guard shook his head.
"I just don't like the heat, that's all."
Avienda picked up her rock and began to walk back across the green. After some contemplation, she had determined that being a wetlander required 1 common attribute, a fondness for complaining. During her 1st months in the wetlands, she had considered this shameful. Did that guard not care that he was losing face in front of his fellow by exposing his weakness? They were all like that, even Elaine. If you listened to her talk about the aches, sicknesses, and frustrations of her pregnancy, you would almost think she was approaching death. However, if complaining was something that Elaine did, then Avienda refused to accept it as a sign of weakness. Her 1st sister would not act in such a shameful way. Therefore, there had to be some hidden honor in it. Perhaps the wetlanders exposed their weaknesses to their companions as a means of offering friendship and trust. If your friends knew of your weaknesses, it would give them an advantage should you dance the spears with them. Or, perhaps, the complaining was a wetlander way of showing humility, much as the Gaishain showed honor by being subservient. She had asked Elaine about her theories and had received only a fond laugh in return. Was it some aspect of wetlander society that she was forbidden to discuss with outsiders then? Had Elaine laughed because Avienda had figured out something she was not meant to? Either way, it was certainly a way to show honor, and that satisfied Avienda. If only her own problems with the wise ones were as simple. It was expected that the wetlanders would act in erratic, unnatural ways, but what was she to do when wise ones behaved so strangely? She was growing frustrated, not with the wise ones, but with herself. She was strong and brave. Not as brave as some others, of course. She could only wish to be as bold as Elaine. Still, Avienda could think of only a few problems which she hadn't been able to solve with the application of spears, the one power, or her wits. Yet she had failed utterly at deciphering her current predicament. She reached the other side of the camp and deposited her stone, then brushed off her hands. The maidens stood motionless and contemplative. Avienda moved to the other pile and picked up an oblong rock with a jagged edge. It was 3 handspans wide, and the smooth surface threatened to slip in her fingers. She had to shift it several times before getting a good purchase. She headed back across the trampled winter thatch, past Saldaean tents, toward the manor house. Elaine would say that Avienda hadn't thought the problem through. Elaine was calm and thoughtful when other people were tense. Avienda sometimes grew frustrated with how much her first sister liked to talk before committing to action. I need to be more like her. I need to remember that I'm not a maiden of the spear any longer. I can't charge in with weapon held high. She needed to approach problems as Elaine did. That was the only way she was going to get her honor back, and only then could claim Randall Thor and make him hers, as much as he was Elaine's or Min's. She could feel him through the bond. He was in his room, but was not sleeping. He pushed himself hard and slept too little. The stone slipped in her fingers, and she nearly stumbled as she rebalanced her weight, hefting it in tired arms. Some of Bashir's soldiers walked past, bemused expressions on their faces, and Avienda felt herself blush. Although they might not know that she was being punished, she was shamed before them. How would Elaine reason out this situation? The Wise Ones were angry at Avienda for not learning quickly enough, and yet they didn't teach her. They just asked those questions. Questions about what she thought of their situation, questions about Randall Thor, or about the way Ruark had handled meeting with the Kara Karn. Avienda couldn't help feeling that the questions were tests. Was she answering incorrectly? If so, why didn't they instruct her in the proper responses? The Wise Ones didn't think she was soft. What was left? What would Elaine say? Avienda wished for her spears back so that she could stab something, attack, test herself against another, work out her anger. No, she thought forcefully. I am going to learn to do this as a wise one. I will find honor again. She reached the manor and dropped her rock. She wiped her brow. Ignoring heat and cold, as Elaine had taught her, didn't keep her from sweating when she worked her body this hard. Adrin? One Dorgard asked his companion. Light, you don't look well, truly. Avienda glanced toward the doorway into the manor. The guard who had been complaining about the heat was sagging against the doorway, hand on his forehead. He really didn't look well. Avienda embraced Saidar. She wasn't the best at healing, but perhaps she could... The man reached up suddenly, scratching at the skin of his temples. His eyes rolled up in his head, and his fingers tore gashes in his flesh. Only, instead of blood, the wounds spat out a black, charcoal-like substance. Avienda could feel the intense heat, even from a distance. The other guard gaped in horror as his friend ripped lines of black fire down the sides of his head. A blackish tar oozed out, boiling and hissing. The man's clothing burst into flames, and his flesh shriveled from the heat. He didn't utter a sound. Avienda shrugged off her shock, immediately weaving air in a simple pattern to pull the unaffected guard to safety. His friend was now just a pulsing mound of black tar which in places sprouted blackened bones. There was no skull. The heat was so strong that Avienda had to back away, pulling the guard with her. We're being attacked, the man whispered. Channelers! No, Avienda said. This is something far more evil. Run for help. He seemed too shocked to move, but she shoved him into motion and he began to move. The tar itself didn't seem to be spreading, which was a blessing, but it had already ignited the door frame of the manor. It could have the entire building in flames before anyone inside was aware of the danger. Avienda wove air and water, intending to extinguish the flame. However, her weaves frazzled and wavered when they got near the fire. They didn't unweave, but this fire somehow resisted them. She took another step back from the awesome burning intensity. Her brow prickled with sweat, and she had to raise her arm to shade her face from the heat. She could barely make out the black char at the center as it began to glow with the deep red and white of extremely hot coals. Soon, only hints of the black remained. The fire spread across the front wall of the building. Avienda heard screams from inside. Avienda shook herself, then growled and wove earth and air, pulling chunks of the ground up around her. She hurled these at the fire, seeking to smother it. Her weave could not draw the heat out, but that did not stop her from using weaves to cast items into the fire. Chunks of grass-covered earth sizzled and hissed, wan blades flashing to ash before the incredible heat. Avienda continued to work, sweating from both the exertion and the temperature. In the distance, she heard people, perhaps the guard among them, calling for buckets. Buckets? Of course. In the Threefold Land, water was far too valuable to use in fighting fires. Dirt or sand was used. But here, they would use water. Avienda took several steps backward, searching out the curling river that ran beside the manor. She could just barely make out its surface, reflecting the dancing reds and oranges of the flames. Already the entire front of the manor was aflame. She felt channeling from inside, Aes Sedai or wise ones. Hopefully they would escape out of the back of the building. The fire had engulfed the inner hallway, and the rooms off of it had no doors out. Avienda wove a massive column of air and water, pulling a spout of crystalline liquid from the river and drawing it toward her. The column of water undulated in the air like the creature on Rand's banner, a glassy, serpentine dragon that slammed against the flames. Steam hissed outward in an explosion, washing over her. The heat was powerful and the wave of steam scalded her skin, but she did not back down. She pulled more water, hurling a thick column of it at the darkened mound, which she could only just make out through the steam. That heat was so intense. Avienda stumbled backward a few steps, gritting her teeth, continuing to work. Then there was a sudden explosion as another column of water burst from the river and slammed into the fire. This, along with her own, diverted nearly the entire flow of the river. Avienda blinked. The other column was being directed by weaves she could not see, but she did notice a figure standing in a window up on the second floor, hand forward, face concentrating intensely. Naif, one of Rand's Ashaman. It was said he was particularly strong with air. The fires had retreated, only the tarry mound remained, radiating a powerful heat. The wall near it and the entryway inside had become a gaping, blackened hole. Avienda continued to pull water and dump it on the charred black mass, though she was beginning to feel extremely tired. Handling so much water required her to channel almost to her capacity. Soon the water stopped hissing. Avienda slacked her flow, then let it dribble to a stop. The ground around her was a wet, blackened disarray that smelled heavily of soggy ash. Bits of wood and char floated in the muddy water, and the holes where she had ripped up earth were filled, making pools. She walked forward hesitantly, inspecting the lump that was the remains of the unfortunate soldier. It was glassy and black, like obsidian, and it sparkled wetly. She picked up a length of singed wood, broken from the wall by the force of her water column, and poked at the mass. It was hard and firm.
"Burn you!"
a voice bellowed. Avienda looked up. Randall Thor strode through the broken hole that now formed the front of the mansion. He stared at the sky, shaking his fist.
"I am the one you want. You will have your war soon enough."
"Rand," Avienda said hesitantly. Soldiers were milling about the green, looking concerned, as if expecting a battle. Bewildered servants peeked out of rooms inside the manor. The entire episode with the flames had taken less than 5 minutes.
"I will stop you,"
Rand roared, causing calls of fright from both servants and soldiers.
"Do you hear me? I am coming for you. Don't waste your power. You will need it against me."
"Rand," Avienda called. He froze, then looked down at her, dazed. She met his eyes, and she could feel his anger, almost as she'd felt the intense flames just a short time before. He turned and stalked away, walking back into the building and up the blackened wooden steps.
"Light,"
an anxious voice called. "Does this sort of thing happen often when he is near?" Avienda turned to see a young man in an unfamiliar uniform standing and watching. He was lanky, with light brown hair and coppery skin. She didn't remember his name, but she was fairly certain he was one of the officers Rand had brought back after meeting with Rodal Iteralda. She turned back to the mess, listening to soldiers call orders in the distance. Bashir had arrived and was taking command, telling men to watch the perimeter, though he was likely just giving them something to do. This was not the beginning of an attack. It was just another of the Dark One's touches on the world, like meat spoiling, beetles and rats appearing from nothing, and men dropping dead of strange diseases. Yes, Avienda said in response to the man's question. It happens often. More often around the Karakarn than in other places, at least. You have had similar events among your own men?
I have heard stories, he said, only I dismissed them.
Not all stories are exaggerations, she said, looking at the blackened remains of the soldier. The Dark One's prison is weak.
Bloody ashes, the young man said, turning away. What have you gotten us into, Rodal?
The man shook his head and stalked off. Bashir's officers began calling orders, organizing the men to clean up. Would Rand move out of the manor now? When pockets of evil appeared, people often wanted to leave. And yet, through her bond with Rand, she felt no urgency. In fact, it seemed that he had gone back to rest. That man's moods were becoming as erratic as Elaine's during her pregnancy. Avienda shook her head and started gathering burned chunks of wood to help clean. As she worked, several Aes Sedai came out of the building and began inspecting the damage. The entire front of the manor was scored with black marks, and the hole where the entryway had been was at least 15 feet across. One of the women, Maurice, eyed Avienda appreciatively.
A shame, she said.
Avienda straightened up, lifting a piece of charred wood, her clothing still soaked. With those clouds covering the sun, it would be long before she was dry.
A shame? She asked.
About the manor? The portly Lord Talayan, owner of the place, moaned to himself as he sat on a stool inside the entryway, wiping his brow and shaking his head.
No, Maurice said. A shame about you, child. Your skill with weaves, it is impressive. If we had you in the White Tower, you'd have been an Aes Sedai by now. Your weaving, it has some roughness to it, but you'd learn to fix that quickly if taught by sisters.
There was an audible sniff, and Avienda spun. Milane stood behind her. The golden-haired wise one had her arms folded beneath her breasts, and her stomach was starting to bulge with child. Her face was not amused. How had Avienda let the woman walk up behind her without hearing? She was letting her fatigue make her careless. Milane and Maurice stared at each other for a long moment. Then the tall Aes Sedai spun in a flurry of green skirts and moved off to speak with the servants who had been trapped by the flames, asking if any of them needed healing. Milane watched her go, then shook her head.
Insufferable woman, she muttered. To think how we once regarded them.
Wise one? Avienda asked.
I'm stronger than most Aes Sedai, Avienda, and you're far stronger than I am. You have a control and understanding of weaves that puts most of us to shame. Others have to struggle to learn what comes naturally to you. Roughness to your weaves, she says. I doubt any of the Aes Sedai, save perhaps Cudswain Sedai, could have managed what you did with that column of water. Moving water that far required you to use the river's own flow and pressure.
Is that what I did? Avienda asked, blinking. Milane eyed her, then snorted again softly to herself.
Yes, that is what you did.
You have such great talent, child. Avienda swelled with praise. From wise ones, it was rare, but always sincere.
But you refuse to learn, Milane continued. There isn't much time.
Here, I have another question for you. What do you think of Randall Thor's plan to kidnap these Damani merchant chiefs? Avienda blinked again, so tired it was hard to think. It defied reason that the Damani used merchants as leaders in the first place. How could a merchant lead people? Did not merchants have to focus on their wares? It was ridiculous. Would the wetlanders ever stop shocking her with their strange ways? And why was Malayne asking her about this now of all times? His plan seems a good one, wise one, Avienda said. Yet the spears do not like being used for kidnapping. I think the Karakarn should have spoken in terms of offering protection, forced protection for the merchants. The chiefs would have responded better to being told they were protecting rather than kidnapping. They would be doing the very same thing, no matter what you call it. But what you call a thing is important, Avienda said. It is not dishonest if both definitions are true. Milane's eyes twinkled, and Avienda caught a hint of a smile on her lips. What else do you think of the meeting? Randall Thor still seems to think that the Karakarn can make demands like a wetlander king. This is my shame. I failed to explain the right way. Milane waved a hand. You have no shame there. We all know how bull-headed the Karakarn is. The wise ones have tried as well, and none have been able to train him correctly. So, that wasn't the reason for her dishonor before the wise ones. What was it, then? Avienda ground her teeth in frustration, then forced herself to continue. Regardless, he needs to be reminded, again and again. Ruark is a wise and patient man, but not all clan chiefs are so. I know that some of the others wonder if their decision to follow Randall Thor was an error. True, Milane said. But look at what happened to the Shido. I did not say they were right, wise one, Avienda said. A group of soldiers were hesitantly trying to pry up the glassy black mound. It appeared to have fused to the ground. Avienda lowered her voice. They are wrong to question the Karakarn, but they are speaking to one another. Randall Thor needs to realize that they will not accept offense after offense from him without end. They may not turn against him like the Shido, but I would not put it past Timelin, for instance, to simply return to the Threefold Land and leave the Karakarn to his arrogance. Milane nodded. Do not worry. We are aware of this possibility. That meant wise ones had been sent to soothe Timelin, who was chief of the Miagoma Aiel. It would not be the first time. Did Randall Thor know how hard the wise ones worked behind his back to maintain Aiel loyalty? Probably not. He saw them all as one homogeneous group, sworn to him to be used. That was one of Rand's great weaknesses. He could not see that Aiel, like other people, did not like being used as tools. The clans were far less tightly knit than he believed. Blood feuds had been put aside for him. Couldn't he understand how incredible that was? Couldn't he see how tenuous that alliance continued to be? But not only was he a wetlander by birth, he was not a wise one. Few Aiel themselves saw the work the wise ones did in a dozen different areas. How simple life had seemed when she had been a maiden. It would have dazzled her to know how much went on beyond her sight. Milane stared blindly at the broken building. A remnant of a remnant, she said as if to herself. And if he leaves us burned and broken like those boards, what will become of the Aiel then? Do we limp back to the Threefold Land and continue as we did before? Many will not want to leave. These lands offer too much. Avienda blinked at the weight of those words. She had rarely given thought to what would happen after the Karakarn was finished with them. She was centered on the now, upon regaining her honor and being there to protect Randall Thor at the last battle. But a wise one could not just think of the now or the tomorrow. She had to think of the years ahead and the times that would be brought upon the winds. A remnant of a remnant. He had broken the Aiel as a people. What would become of them? Milane glanced back at Avienda, her face softening. Go to the tents, child, and rest.
You look like a Sharadan that has crawled on his belly across 3 days of sand. Avienda looked down at her arms, seeing the flakes of ash from the burnings. Her clothing was soaked and stained, and she suspected that her face was just as filthy. Her arms ached from carrying the stones all day. Once she acknowledged the fatigue, it seemed to crash upon her like a windstorm. She gritted her teeth and forced herself to remain upright. She would not shame herself by collapsing. But she did turn to leave, as instructed.
"Oh, and Avienda," Milane called. "We will discuss your punishment tomorrow."
She turned in shock.
"For not finishing with the stones," Milane said, surveying the wreckage again. "And for not learning quickly enough. Go."
Avienda sighed. Another round of questions, and another undeserved punishment. There was a correlation of some sort. But what? She was too exhausted to think about it for now. All she wanted was her bed, and she found herself treacherously recalling the soft, luxurious mattresses back in the palace of Camelin. She forced those thoughts out of her mind. Sleep that soundly, muffled in pillows and down comforters, and you'd be too relaxed to wake if someone tried to kill you in the night. How had she let Elaine convince her to sleep in one of those soft, feathered death traps? Another thought occurred to her as she pushed that one away. A treacherous one. A thought of Randall Thor, resting in his room. She could go to him. No, not until she had her honor back. She would not go to him as a beggar. She would go to him as a woman of honor, assuming that she could ever figure out what she was doing wrong. She shook her head and trotted toward the Aiel camp at the side of the green. Chapter 12. Unexpected Encounters. Egwene walked the cavernous halls of the White Tower, lost in thought. Her two red keepers trailed along behind. They seemed a little sullen these days. Elida ordered them to stay with Egwene more and more often. Though the individuals changed, there were almost always two with her. And yet, it seemed that they could sense that Egwene considered them to be attendants rather than guards. It had been well over a month since Swan had conveyed her disturbing news in Telairun Riod, but still Egwene thought about it. The events were a reminder that the world was coming apart. This was a time when the White Tower should have been a source of stability. Instead, it divided against itself, while Randall Thor's men bonded sisters. How could Rand have allowed such a thing? There was obviously little left of the youth with whom she'd grown up. Of course, there was little of the youthful Egwene left, either. Gone were the days when the two of them had seemed destined to end up married, living on a little farm in the Two Rivers. That, oddly, led her to thinking of Gawain. How long had it been since she'd last seen him, stealing kisses in Cairhien? Where was he now? Was he safe? "Keep focused," she told herself. "Clean the patch of floor you're working on first before you move on to the rest of the house. Gawain could look after himself." He'd done a competent job of that in the past. Too competent, in some cases. Swan and the others would deal with the Ashaman matter. The other news was far more disturbing. One of the Forsaken, in the camp? A woman, yet channeling Sidene instead of Sidar? Egwene would have called it impossible once. Yet she had seen ghosts in the halls of the White Tower, and the corridors seemed to rearrange on a daily basis. This was just another sign. She shivered. Halima had touched Egwene, supposedly massaging her headaches away. Those headaches disappeared as soon as Egwene had been captured. Why hadn't she considered that Halima might have been causing them? What else had the woman been plotting? What hidden knots would the Aes Sedai stumble over? What traps had she laid? One section of the floor at a time. Clean what you could reach, then move on. Swan and the others would have to deal with Halima's plots, too. Egwene's backside hurt, but the pain was growing increasingly irrelevant to her.
Sometimes she laughed when beaten, sometimes not. The strap was unimportant. The greater pain, what had been done to Tarvalin, was far more demanding. She nodded to a group of white-clothed novices as they passed her in the hallway, and they bobbed down in curtsies. Egwene frowned, but didn't chastise them. She just hoped that they wouldn't draw penances from the trailing reds for showing deference to Egwene. Her goal was the quarters of the brown Aja, the section that was now down in the wing. Medani had taken her time volunteering to train Egwene today. The command had finally come today, weeks after the first dinner with Elida. Oddly, however, Benai Nalsad had also offered to give her instruction this day. Egwene hadn't spoken to the Shinaran Brown since that first conversation some weeks before. She'd never repeated lessons with the same woman twice, and yet the name had been given to her in the morning as the first of the day's visits. When she reached the east wing, which now held the brown sector of the tower, her red minders reluctantly took up positions in the hallway outside, waiting for her return. Elida probably would have liked them to stay with Egwene, but after the reds themselves had been so exacting in protecting their boundary, there was little chance of another Aja, even the mild browns, letting a pair of red sisters infiltrate their quarters. Egwene hurried her pace as she entered the section with brown-tiled floors, passing bustling women in nondescript, muted dresses. It was going to be a full day, with her appointments with sisters, her scheduled beatings, and her regular novice load of scrubbing floors or other chores. She arrived at Benai's door, but hesitated there. Most sisters agreed to train Egwene only when forced into the duty, and the experience was often unpleasant. Some of Egwene's teachers disliked her because of her affiliation with the rebels. Others were annoyed by how easily she could craft weaves, and still others were infuriated to find that she would not show them respect, like a novice. These lessons, however, had been among Egwene's best chances to sow seeds against Elida. She'd planted one of those during her first visit with Benai. Had it begun to sprout? Egwene knocked, and then entered at the call to come in. The sitting room inside was cluttered with the refuse of scholarship. Stacks and stacks of books, like miniature city towers, leaned against one another. Skeletons of various creatures were mounted in various states of construction. The woman owned enough bones to populate a menagerie. Egwene shivered when she noticed a full human skeleton in the corner, held upright and bound together with threads, some detailed notations written directly on the bones in black ink. There was barely room to walk, and only one clear place to sit. Benai's own stuffed chair, the armrests worn with a twin set of depressions, doubtless where the brown's arms had rested during countless late-night reading sessions. The ceiling felt lower for the several mummified fowl and astronomical contraptions which hung above. Egwene had to duck her head beneath a model of the sun in order to reach the place where Benai stood rifling through a stack of leather-bound volumes. "Ah," she said as she noticed Egwene. "Good." Slender in a bony sort of way, she had dark hair that was streaked with gray from age. The hair was in a bun, and she, like many browns, wore a simple dress that hadn't been fashionable for a century or two. Benai moved over to her stuffed sitting chair, ignoring the siffer chairs by the hearth. Both of those had accumulated stacks of papers since Egwene's previous visit. Egwene cleared off a stool, placing the dusty skeleton of a rat on the floor between two stacks of books about the reign of Archer Hawkwing. "Well, I suppose we should get on with your instruction, then," Benai said, settling back in her chair. Egwene kept her face calm.